session pursuant to law.
Thank you, everyone. Please be seated, and good morning once again. We welcome you to the third final case of our term here at the University of Idaho College of Law in Moscow. And the case now before the court is entitled State of Idaho versus Mark Langford. In this case, you will note that two of the justices on the court have recused themselves. So we have today Senior Justice Roger Burdick, who is sitting with the court, as well as Judge Cynthia Meyer, who is sitting pro tem, and will participate, each of them, fully today, as well as in rendering the ultimate decision in this case. With that, I believe we were going to have a high school class here, but are they here yet, the Clark Fork students? So we also have Clark Fork High School Government class. Welcome. We're glad to have you here, as well as the law students. We hope this is informative for you, and that it's worth your time coming to be with us. We're glad to come and leave Boise, and even though it requires the attorneys to do the same, at times it's a good exercise, and we're really happy to be able to do this. So with that, counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters for us before your argument today?
Nothing from the state, Your Honor.
I think I failed to mention Garth McCarty represents Mr. Langford, and L. Lamont Anderson of the state of Idaho. So thank you again, gentlemen, for making the trip. Mr. McCarty.
May it please the court, counsel. You know, I always said that the one thing more nerve-wracking than appearing and arguing in front of the Supreme Court is having to do a presentation in front of law school. Now I'm not other high school students. I feel like this is some sort of revenge for all the classes I spent sitting up near the door so I could leave early.
Make sure and speak up so those can hear you back there.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully I won't be turning in their direction too many times during the
argument.
Your Honor, my intent today is to use my limited time addressing the first two issues in our briefing. And I think we'll see if we get too much the second as it is. Well, I think we'll just have to see how it plays out. But as for the third issue, the speedy trial issue, I do intend to stand on our written briefing on that today. I do sincerely want to thank the court and the University of Idaho for holding arguments here in Moscow on this case. This is my hometown. It's always been good to me. But I can't help but reflect on the fact that 40 years ago today, I would have been sitting in a classroom a few blocks from here at Russell Elementary School in the second grade. And that same year, Mark Langford was arrested in this case and has been in custody ever since. Now, over those 40 years, this court has reviewed Mr. Langford's cases. He's now had three trials. And the last time this court reviewed its second trial, that was the 2008 trial, this court remanded that case, finding fatal errors occurred in that trial. And presumably, this court expected those errors to be cured by the state in the third trial. Well, now here we are after the third trial, and the state failed to make those cures. The state's case in the third trial, and as of today, is actually weaker than it was after the second trial when this court determined that there were sufficiency of evidence issues. And of course, the court's language about sufficiency of evidence came during that Brady analysis. I'm sure there'll be some questions about that. But let's just reflect on this for a moment. In the second trial in 2008, and any time I think, if I get lazy with my language, any time that I'm talking about corroborating evidence, the necessity of corroborating accomplices' testimony or sufficiency evidence, what I'm talking about in this argument is with respect to the intent, the element of intent to commit robbery prior to homicides. And I don't think it's in dispute that there is sufficient evidence that homicides occurred. Clearly, the Robinses were killed. I don't think there's a sufficiency of evidence dispute with respect to Mark Langford being an accessory after the fact. But the issue, as this court pointed out after the second trial, where sufficiency of evidence is lacking is on that necessary required element that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That Mark Lankford formed the culpable mental state of intent to commit robbery for the state in homicides. And what this, well, going back to, that second trial, the state was able to put Brian Lankford on the stand, Brian Lankford being Mark's brother and also allegedly an accomplice in the case. Brian Lankford in that trial testified against Mark. He provided evidence for the state, not only that Mark participated in the homicides, but that he did so in the course of committing a robbery, potentially. Then the state put on the testimony of a jailhouse informant named Lane Thomas. Lane Thomas provided testimony that while he was in the jail, Mark had confessed to him, not just that he participated in the homicides, but in particular that he had done so in order to rob the robbery. Now, of course, ultimately, Lane Thomas's testimony became problematic for the state because there was a discovery violation that this court determined was material. It was a Brady and an approved violation. Brady violation, send it back. But in making that determination, this court determined that Lane Thomas' testimony was the only testimony that corroborated the alleged accomplice testimony with respect to that critical element of intent to commit robbery. And that it was essential for the state to obtain a conviction.
Was that the issue as concerns Thomas' testimony during trial?
Your Honor, I think...
Or even on appeal?
Well, I think what you're asking me is the issue was a Brady analysis, correct?
Brady was stricken because of a Brady violation, not because of the content of the testimony, nor the efficacy of sin.
Well, I might disagree with some of the language you chose, but I think I agree ultimately. The court was evaluating the issue under a Brady analysis and making the determination that the Lane Thomas testimony was material. The court said, and these are the court's words, that it was material because the Lane Thomas testimony corroborated Brian's testimony and was essential to the state to obtain a conviction. The courts, this court, said that the conviction in that case hinged upon the Lane Thomas testimony. The court could have just said Lane Thomas' testimony was material. It was.
But haven't we said in Garcia that even if some testimony is in a second proceeding or an appellate proceeding, stricken or not used, you can go back in the third or second trial and present evidence, and it stands alone, irrespective of some loose language in Lankford 2.
I don't believe it was loose language, first of all, Your Honor, but I think more importantly, the state didn't substitute that. They didn't find substitute evidence to present to make basically a sufficiency of the evidence establishment. Lane Thomas was not recalled, and they didn't substitute anyone else to corroborate Brian's testimony. And, just as importantly, Brian came to the third trial, testified under oath that he committed these homicides and that Mark wasn't even present and didn't know about it. And so even their accomplice testimony, which was the only evidence they had to establish that intent to commit robbery, even that failed. Now, of course, the state can say we were able to get in previous testimony, and it's impeachment, through impeaching Brian Lankford and the jury, that's sure, but we have an even weaker case for the state going into the third trial with no substitute for that corroborating evidence. So sure, this court was conducting a Brady analysis on the issue of materiality. It was. But because the headliner issue was Brady, doesn't make this court's legal findings, legal conclusions about how essential that testimony was false.
Excuse me, madam.
So are you arguing that it has become the law of the case that we must follow today?
Correct. This isn't a different defendant or a different crime. This is the same case. the same evidence, the same charge, for the same defendant. And when this court made those legal conclusions and sent the case back...
What legal conclusion?
The legal conclusion that the... Well, it's layered. But the legal conclusion that the additional evidence, in addition to Brian's testimony, was required, was essential to conviction, and that the conviction hinged upon it, and cited to the statute that requires corroboration of an accomplice's testimony. And the court didn't have to do that.
But didn't we hold in Dunlap that the law of the case doctrine refers to principles or rules of law, not whether facts are material in the case or not?
But didn't this court make a finding that with respect to corroboration and with respect to sufficiency of evidence, that the reason that that Lane Thomas testimony, or in theory any substitute that would have achieved the same thing Lane Thomas' testimony did, was necessary and essential because of the legal requirement that the state corroborate that accomplice testimony?
I understand your argument, but to get there through the law of the case doctrine just seems to be a misapplication of that doctrine, which typically refers to, it's called the law of the case doctrine because it's talking about the law that will be applied to that case, not factual findings of an appellate body, supposedly, that are going to be binding on future prosecutions of the case.
Well, I guess I would ask the court to rule in this case that the court meant what it said, and that it said what it meant when it said that Brian's accomplice testimony had to be corroborated. Right. And the state in this
So case, is the law of the case doctrine the only way to get there? Because it seems to me that doctrine doesn't... I realize you disagree. For me, that seems like it's inapplicable. Is there another way to get there, then?
Well, this would just be a sufficiency of the evidence argument, right, because ultimately the trial court in this case erred by failing to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal. I think the law of the case is... I think the reason the law of the case is persuasive, judgment should be... should be persuasive in this case, because this court made those particular findings with respect to the same set of facts and the same evidence, and that the state never did anything different in the third trial to sort of get that evidence in through another way. So how could it be different in the third?
It almost feels like a unique form of estoppel, that if we've said something in a prior decision about the facts in a case, they apply to a subsequent trial, even if it's not the exact same crime.
Well, certainly in this case where the court made these legal conclusions about the significance of that additional testimony, and where the state didn't do anything different in the third trial except to exclude that additional testimony, certainly those legal conclusions would still be applicable the third time around.
But that assumes that the state's theory of the case, their evidence of the case, their presentation of the case was identical to this third trial. And to my understanding, the state disagrees with that.
It nearly was, Your Honor, and in particular, not only was it nearly the same, and I think we can argue over some of the minor differences, but some of it was verbatim the same. In fact, much of it, if not most of it, was verbatim.
Wasn't that because some of the witnesses had died?
Correct.
And the court made a finding under the rules that, in fact, that witness was not available, and pursuant to our due process, that prior recorded testimony subject to cross-examination could be used.
And I don't mean to add a new issue here for you to decide, but that is the case, Your Honor. I mean, there were transcripts upon transcripts upon transcripts that ultimately were read to the jury in this case. But I'm just making the point that not only was the evidence substantially similar, in many instances it was identical to what the previous jury had.
I understand.
The closing arguments weren't identical, though. The attorneys interpreted the evidence in a unique way in this trial, didn't they?
I would say that it's true, which brings us to the second issue. If you're ready to go there, I certainly can. Please, any more questions on issue one. But the second issue has to do with some of the statements that Brian, made at prison in phone calls a year before the trial that were dropped into the defense's lap in the middle of this third trial, at a time when the defense couldn't do anything with those at that point. It was too late for them to make use of them. It was too late for them to meet any harm that would come from it. And those were statements that the state ultimately argued. I wouldn't be here arguing this. I don't think we would be arguing the state if the state hadn't not only used those statements but then told the jury that they're the most important part. Now, I interpret that to mean the most important part of the case, but you can read the transcripts, and those were the words that the prosecutor used, telling the jury in the closing argument, the most important part is that Brian made these statements that he wanted to turn the prosecution upside down, that he wanted to do everything he could to help his brother get acquitted. And not only was that basically pushed on the jury as the most important part, but then again in the rebuttal closing, the prosecutor followed up again and said, this is how you know that when Brian confessed to the crime the other day, he was lying. This is how you know that he had a motive to provide that false testimony. And it was that grab, that extraordinary prejudice that is seen not only from those words, but as Your Honor says, it also shows that the prosecution changed its whole entire theory based on this evidence that that they had not disclosed that they should have. Now, with respect to that evidence, the trial court failed in several respects. The trial court never did a Rule 16 analysis, as far as I can tell, on the record that we have. It never did an actual analysis of whether the items should have been disclosed, as we certainly have argued they should have been, or any analysis into the facts and circumstances surrounding the prosecution's failure to disclose until the middle of the trial. And the trial court never appeared to do any analysis of the prejudice that the defense suffered as a result of that lack of disclosure.
Let me ask you about prejudice then, since you bring that up.
Yes.
And again, this is a massive record. My recollection was there were objections, contemporary objections made, that claimed that this evidence was merely cumulative. And I'm just wondering about the consistency of your cumulative argument with your prejudice argument. If this was just cumulative evidence, why would it have made a difference?
Judge, I'm so sorry, Your Honor.
I'm a trial lawyer. I'm sitting next to a judge.
I'm a trial lawyer, and sometimes the words just still slip out the way that it would in a trial. But, Your Honor, the transcripts are important because there was a long series of events and objections. And it is confusing, and the fact that it's so confusing is one of the reasons that I would submit to the court, the trial court's in error, because there are inexplicable decisions being made by the trial court in this case. But, first of all, the defense did file in advance of trial written objections to any late disclosures on constitutional grounds and on a number of other grounds as well. When this particular disclosure occurred in the middle of the trial, defense counsel did one of the few things that I would say on this issue that he did really well. He did articulate a good constitutional argument, a 403 argument, in objection to any admission of those statements. The trial judge then determined that those statements were unfairly prejudicial. And part of the reason for that is that they were entangled with this context of Marks being incarcerated, which was something the jury was not allowed to know. Brian wasn't allowed to talk about it, the defense wasn't allowed to talk about it, the prosecution wasn't allowed to talk about it. But talking about those statements in their context would require talking about Brian's statements, getting Mark out of prison, what Mark could do from out of prison compared to in, and some lawsuit discussion and so on. So those objections were made well at the start. The judge made a ruling that those statements should be suppressed based on being unfairly prejudicial and cumulative. And then the prosecution said, this is one of the most bizarre things that I've read in trial transcripts. The prosecution says, okay, Judge, well, something to be effective. Okay, Judge, but I intend to ask Brian those questions about the statements anyway, as is my right. And it's unclear to me whether the trial court misunderstood what the prosecution was saying or what, but ultimately the trial court just said, yes, I agree. And so even though the trial court had just made a ruling that they were unfairly prejudicial and should be excluded, it came in anyway. The court never disavowed its prior ruling. It never made a record as to why it was changing its ruling. And then ultimately the defense spoke up and said cumulative, which was the last thing the trial court had said before suppressing that evidence. And I take that to just be the defense attorney attempting to use the language that the trial court was using to keep the rule.
I can understand why you want to look at it that way, but if the defense says the evidence is merely cumulative and now says it was prejudicial, I'm just trying to reconcile. Because it seems like those are two inconsistent positions.
Your Honor, I would argue that the pretrial filings would apply as objections throughout the entire trial. They are not split throughout. But then in addition, the very thoughtful objections that you made a few minutes before that also suffice as objections. And I don't think that he disavowed his objections any more than the court disavowed its prior ruling before, ultimately, those statements came in.
You made the statement that the pretrial objections carry through the entire trial.
Right.
But not all of them were ruled upon by the judge. It was basically akin to a motion in limine that the criminal defense attorney has put in. And we all know that a motion in limine is a castle made on sand, depending upon the evidence that is presented. So why would we say, if you make some sort of general objection at the beginning of a trial, and then we have evidence that builds and builds and builds, that it would, without saying anything more, apply to a statement by a witness?
I think trial counsel did a good job at making clear that there were constitutional objections that would be made, that would occur no matter what it was.
On this specific issue?
On any failure to disclose that came in during trial, in the middle of trial, which is what happened. But I also think that trial counsel's objections a few minutes before, I don't think they expired. And I think that...
I would agree with you. Then you do have, as an attorney in a case, state or defense, to object at the time. I'm just objecting to these blanket objections carrying the day throughout the trial. That would be chaos.
As a defense attorney, it might be good chaos, but Your Honor...
You forget I was a public defender for four counties for 5 years.
So you know what I mean. But I do think that it's important that the trial counsel made thorough objections going beyond just the cumulative objections.
On this issue, I would agree with you, sir. Yeah. I would agree
with
you, sir.
And so I think it would be unfair for the court to determine that those somehow expired over a few minutes. And also, I think the court should recognize that the trial court's inexplicable reversal of his own ruling on this case. It's very hard to explain.
Did you specifically say the judge said, yes, I agree?
Yeah, I apologize, Judge Stead. Your Honor, I apologize that I don't have the...
that effect?
Correct.
Could that not be an inference that, yes, you have the right to ask that question if it's objected to, I will respond at that time?
Possibly, but if the court agreed that the statements could be expressed to the jury, which they ultimately were, and when you read that transcript, there were plenty of objections that should have been made. I think we can all agree that the prosecution ultimately testified to those statements to that jury, didn't properly impeach, and then ultimately used and even misrepresented those statements.
Without objection.
Without objection. Committing prosecutorial misconduct that was extremely prejudicial. Defense counsel did fail, and I hope if you get it, you'll remember this when this comes back on a post-conviction. Remember that defense counsel failed to make some of those critical objections. However, the way that this played out, the trial court still had a responsibility to make a record of why its opinion would have changed, what facts and law and circumstances apply to make the trial judge reverse its own decision and allow these questions to be asked when it had just determined that asking those questions of Brian and submitting that information would be unfairly prejudicial. It had just done that a minute or two before.
I keep coming back to prejudice. Assuming there was an error involved here, this wasn't the only impeachment evidence offered against Brian Langford. Okay? His testimony was all over the place. And I'm just wondering, in light of the fact that he was telling people different things at different times, the fact that he was impeached with evidence you think should have been impeached with, how would that have made things any better if that hadn't come in? It seems like his credibility was under assault throughout the trial.
Yeah, and Brian's credibility at every stage since 1983 forward has been pretty hard to defend. It's pretty hard for anyone to say that he's consistent. But again, Your Honor, you didn't hear and you don't read the prosecution talking about the most important part of their case being some other information related to a future act. The prosecution argued to that jury, and those are the last things ultimately the jury heard going into that jury room to deliberate, was that the reason that we should reject Brian Langford's confession in this case, he confessed to the offenses, and the reason that we should reject that confession is because of these statements ultimately that weren't disclosed until the middle of the trial, having to do with turning the prosecution upside down and helping get his brother acquitted. So the prosecution took those statements and weaponized them. But it was also highly prejudicial because the defense couldn't do anything with them, because even trying to rehabilitate Brian with respect to those statements, they would have had to ask about the contents of the statements, which would have required them violating the pretrial ruling on motion. If the court has no further questions at this time, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
Very well, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I don't mean to be flippant about this case at all, but I think I've heard counsel make the concession that the state should win this case because he wants you to remember something when it comes back on post-conviction. That means the state should win on these issues. At least that's the way that I took this comment. As to the issues that are really before this court, I agree with counsel that the sufficiency of the evidence and the discovery issue are the most important. But in listening to counsel's argument regarding sufficiency and rule of law and the likes, I think we need to take this back to what it is, and that is the denial of a Rule 29 motion, a halftime motion. And counsel wants this court to compare the evidence that was presented at the second trial with the evidence that was presented at the last trial. But I don't recall the district court in the last trial having access to any of the transcripts from the second trial. So I don't know how this court, although this court did indicate in an order that it was taking judicial notice of the prior transcripts and of the prior court's record, but I don't know how this court can reverse a district court based upon something the district court didn't have, which was the transcripts from the first hearing, or from the second trial. I just don't think that's right. Idaho Criminal Rule 29A, which is the motion, or the judge motion for a judgment of acquittal, is very limited in review on appeal. It's not whether this court would find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's whether the evidence and the like most favorable to the prosecution, any rational trier of fact could find the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The court does not substitute its judgment for that of the jury on the issue of witness credibility, which is a big issue in this case, weight of the evidence, or reasonable inferences that should be drawn from those, from the evidence. Now, it ties in, admittedly, this whole judgment of acquittal thing, with the corroboration statute, 1921-17. And because it's so important, I want to read the actual statute. A judgment cannot be had on the testimony of an accomplice unless he is corroborated by other evidence which in itself and without the aid of the testimony of the accomplice tends to connect the defendant with the commission of the offense. And the corroboration is not sufficient if it merely shows the commission of the offense or the circumstances thereof. I think we all know the purpose of the corroboration requirement, the statute. And in fact, that's why the Ninth Circuit reversed the first trial, was because there were competing corroboration jury instructions. One jury instruction said you don't have to corroborate, and two others said they did, and I was unable to convince the Ninth Circuit that the two outweighed the one. And so we ended up with a new trial. But corroboration can be slight. It need only go to one material fact. It can be entirely circumstantial, and it can be furnished by the defendant himself. Now, in this particular case, and I'm going to focus on the facts of this case, because I don't believe law of case, the law of case doctrine has any application here whatsoever. In Langford 3, the court's last decision, this court was focused on Brady and Nepveu and focused on the materiality standard. Yes, the court in its analysis talked about how important Lane Thomas's testimony was, but the court never really looked at any of the other corroboration. And at least in the opinion, that's how I'm going to say it, in the opinion, there's no discussion of the Damon's testimony in the opinion. There's no discussion of what occurred when the two brothers left the Camaro and covered it up with the branches. There's not a lot of discussion of anything other than how important Wayne Thomas's testimony was. But that goes to materiality. And the United States Supreme Court in Kyles versus Wiley said materiality in the context of Brady is not sufficiency of the evidence. They are different standards. So I would suggest that law of the case doctrine has absolutely no application, particularly in this case, because the district judge did not have the transcripts from the second trial. So let's look at the corroboration. Let's just go to sufficiency of the evidence. In Federally, this court talked about the stream of events. And that's where you can start looking to determine whether there is sufficient corroboration. And in Federally, this court said that the stream of events began when the two defendants entered the victim's house, and the stream of events ended when they took the stuff out, when they murdered the man in the middle. I would suggest to this court that the stream of events in this case started at the time that the brothers left the Camaro. And the reason I say that is because Mark Langford believed the Camaro was inoperable. Now, I know that there was testimony later on when the Camaro was recovered. They actually got it started. It doesn't matter. It's what was going on in Mark Langford's head. And he thought that Camaro was inoperable because I believe it was a rock. They hit a rock going up on this really bad road. And there was at least a belief, as I understand it, that possibly an oil pan was damaged, and it wouldn't start. They didn't have a vehicle anymore because the Camaro was damaged. Or maybe it was out of gas. We don't know. But they abandoned that vehicle because it wouldn't work. At that point in time, they had 45 miles to walk to Grangeville. I'm obviously not a walker or a hiker. You can look at me and tell that. But 45 miles is a long ways to be walking, particularly during that particular June, because there was inclement weather. It was cold. On top of that, I believe it was Mark, had hypoglycemia. It was a blood sugar issue. And he was starting to feel the effects of that. And the reason I bring that up is because there was insufficient food, water, or any other provisions. They had no money, virtually no money. I would suggest it was at that point in time that the two brothers started talking about, we got to find a vehicle. That's when the intent was first formed. That's when the beginning of the string of events occurred, was when they abandoned that Camaro. Later on, as the brothers are walking out to the highway, I believe it was, they're picked up between 6 and 6:30 p.m. by Darrell Cox. A continuation of the stream of events. And the reason I say that is because Mark specifically said, take us to McAllister because our family is down there. Now, I would suggest that lie, and he admitted on the stand when he testified that he did lie, their family was nowhere in Idaho, they were in Texas. But that lie, again, showed intent. And it was intent to steal a vehicle. told them, you got miles to go even to get to the McAllister campground. I'll take it. But Cox also mentioned to the brothers that he was going on the Grange. Now, if the brothers were really wanting to get to Grangeville, why didn't they just ride with Cox? The reason was because if they came to Grangeville to steal the vehicle, there were going to be people all over the place. They weren't going to be able to steal a vehicle like they could in a campground. So they get to the McAllister campground. Cox drops them off. Excuse me. And the Damons are there. Now, Chris Damon said, and I quote, they just kind of stood around there, I believe it was for about 15 to 20 minutes, looking at the car, is what Chris Damon said. And then his wife, Julie, said that the two brothers were discussing things with each other, and then she said that they were looking at the car, then the family, then upriver, and then the car again, and I quote, like they were casing the car, end quote. That's intent. That's a continuation of the string of events that occurred in this case. Dewey went on and said that the brothers were, quote, looking at the license plate, looking at us, and then talking to each other, end quote. And then she went ahead and said things were, quote, not on the up and up, end quote. And, of course, Chris is getting pretty concerned at this point in time because these two brothers, they don't look real good, apparently. And Chris is concerned, so concerned, that when his wife wanted to go to the bathroom, down to the restroom, where the brothers apparently walked off in that direction, said, you're not going. And she finally convinced him to say, yeah, I gotta go. And he walked her to the bathroom because of the concerns that he had. I would also suggest to you that the distances that were discussed throughout that trial, and there were a lot of distances, the state presented several, I don't know if I should call them experts, but there were individuals that had measured the difference between different data points, the Camaro, where the Camaro was at, the McAllister on down to some of the other spots. Those time frames and those distances didn't match up with anything Mark Langford said. I would suggest that's corroboration. I would suggest also that there is no way that Brian Langford alone was going to take out Robert DeFonce. Not in the way that Brian described. We're talking about a man that was Mr. Fitness. That's what the Marines called him. Just the opposite of what I am. Brian was no match for Robert. There was no way that Brian was going to take out Robert DeFonce alone. And especially when you consider the fact that Robert was going to protect his young wife, Cheryl. It just wasn't going to happen. The forensic evidence doesn't support, and that's from Dr. Anderson. And if we're going to get into a comparison of what's in the transcript from the second trial versus the transcript from the last trial, Dr. Anderson didn't testify at the last trial. And he said that the broken bones in Cheryl's right hand could be defensive wounds, contradicting Brian's testimony that it was a rock. The fracture on her face was caused by something that was about one and three quarters inches wide. That's not a rock. That's the nightstick that Mark Langford carried around and said, and I quote, if I sink this mother off of somebody's head four or five times, that would be all she wrote for that poor bastard, end quote, referring to his nightstick. I would suggest that the events after the murders constitute the end of the streaming of the events. And that would be the flight from Idaho to San Antonio, they're driving from Idaho to Los Angeles, where they abandoned the van. Going from Los Angeles and getting back to San Antonio, and then going to the Trinity River. Langford's statements to Ray Ramamuto, quote, would never see him again, end quote. The statements to Agent Crawford that he didn't know anything about the DeFonsis murder or the VW van. Those are lies that demonstrate consciousness of guilt. They're not the actions of somebody that's just covering up for a brother. They're actions of someone that is covering up for himself. And that would be the end of the stream of events. I think this case is very, very similar. I believe it's Speak versus Pierce, where there was testimony that the defendant was seen by two accomplices driving the getaway before the robber. And then there was testimony of him driving 30 minutes after the robbery. And this court concluded that that stream of events was sufficient corroboration. It was slight. It wasn't overwhelming. But it was sufficient corroboration in this case, or in that case. And I would suggest that Pierce is very, very similar. One other thing that I want to note. If we're going to compare the transcripts, Julie Damon never said anything in the second trial about those two brothers facing the car. And I think that that is a critical piece of evidence that was provided in this particular trial. That, to me, clearly demonstrates corroboration and, more importantly, a specific intent to steal a car, or a car. A car. I think most importantly are the jury instructions that were provided in this case. This is a case where the jury was properly instructed on the weight and credibility of the testimony. That's out of Garcia. And I would suggest that there is more than sufficient corroboration in this case. As far as the delay disclosure, counsel is trying to bootstrap a closing argument claim here into what is a sanction issue. That's what is really an issue here. And whether the trial court properly sanctioned someone, a party, the state, whoever, the defendant, is reviewed based upon an abuse of discretion standard. That's a pretty high standard. I will agree that I don't entirely understand all that went down as far as the admission of this evidence. Because the district court said it's not coming in. Now, it being the recordings, and that's a fundamental distinction here. The recordings, those are not coming in. And rightfully so, because of the court's pretrial order that said, we're not getting into any of this nonsense associated with Mark being incarcerated or any of that stuff. But the court did make one finding, and I think that if it's not a direct finding on the good cause standard, which is required, it's at least implied. This is in the trial transcript, page 2408. I'm not in any way insinuating, he's talking to the state, I'm not in any way insinuating they should have been discovered, meaning the recordings, or that the state did anything wrong or tried to hide anything or the some intent to not disclose these. Obviously, I'll admit he didn't say, and that's good cause. But that sure sounds like good cause. The state did everything that they could in this case because the state had no reason to go back and try to find 35 years worth of recordings from the Idaho Department of Correction. The prosecutor explained the gargantuan task that would be. It's not part of the record, but I will corroborate that statement. Try to get something from IEOC that's not very narrowly tailored is very, very difficult. And because of something that Brian said regarding Randy Baldwin's testimony that he should have known nothing about, they were able to focus and ask IDOC for the particular recordings. I think think it's important. Yes, there were a lot of objections about the recordings coming in. Confrontation clause, cumulative evidence, due process. There was a string of them. But then when the prosecutor said, well, I would like to put Brian back on the stand, and I'd like to ask him some questions. Not admit the tapes or the recordings, but just ask him some questions about some statements he made. That's a different thing than the recordings. And I would suggest that the prior objections regarding confrontation, etc., don't follow through to what actually happened, which was the admission of those statements, and I believe it was under Idaho Rule 11613.
Let me throw something out for your consideration, because if I tried to reconstruct that in my own mind, one thing I thought, certainly this hasn't been argued, and the record isn't clear on this, but the court said it didn't admit the recordings, but it did allow that subject matter to be questioned about, which touched on what the recordings had. And I'm just wondering if perhaps the court was looking at this as a Rule 613 issue, in which they might be admissible for impeachment purposes, but you had to ask the question first.
And that's what I was getting at, Justice Mueller. I think I meant reference Rule 613. I was talking about Idaho Rule 11613, which I actually brought with me today. Why, I don't know. but I did read it this morning. And the interesting thing in doing it that way is that it completely sanitized whatever else was in those recordings, which are not part of this record. They were never admitted as a court exhibit or any other kind of exhibit. So when Langford talks about, oh, we could have done this, we could have done that, how do we know that?
Well, under 613, the recordings would have only been admissible if he had denied making those statements.
And he didn't deny them, Justice Mueller. The first two statements, he just said, I don't know. And even on the third one, he said, sounds like something I would say, which sounds pretty ambiguous to me. And the prosecutor, from my perspective as an appellate attorney, thankfully, did not read whatever was on the recording. Now, apparently they had a transcript of the recording, I'm assuming. And the prosecutor didn't say, well, Brian, didn't you say so-and-so on such and such a date to Lee John? He didn't do that. He just let the denials go. Which brings me to...
So just to be clear then, these documents were not admitted as an exhibit and they were not read into the record.
That is correct. And from the record that we have to assume, because they are part of the record, we have to assume that the questions that the prosecutor asked were from the recording. And, of course, the first question was following Brian's parole hearing, quote, I'm going to fucking blow them out of the water at Langford's trial. That's the first question. And Brian said, I have no idea if I said that. The second question, if he's found guilty, then that's a bad thing for me. And his response, don't remember, you're talking about a ways back. And the final statement was, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure he's acquitted. And Brian responded, sounds like something I could say. He should be acquitted. He's innocent. I don't know how any of that's prejudicial. I mean, at most, we have the third statement that I would suggest is equivocal. I fail to see the prejudice. One of the complaints that Langford makes in his briefing, I believe it's in his reply briefing on page 10, is the court's alleged failure to consider Idaho Criminal Rule 16. And I think counsel alluded to that today. The reason the court didn't make any specific finding after it was decided that we're not going to admit the recording, I'm only going to allow you to ask questions, is because that's the only objection that was made. Defense counsel objected based upon Idaho Rule of Evidence 403, and that it was too prejudicial. That was the only objection at that point in time. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous to criticize the trial court in this case for not making a ruling when there wasn't a proper objection. And the only objection was either the rule of evidence 403. Again, I would suggest that the three answers that came as a result of the three questions, I just don't see prejudice. Lankford tries to raise a Brady claim based upon this alleged discovered violation. This isn't a Brady claim. I did submit supplemental authorities, State versus Stone. I didn't realize at the time that I wrote my brief that if a Brady, a discovery violation is so bad, it can result in a Brady violation.
Yes. I'm going to ask you a question I should have asked 30 seconds ago. It took me a few seconds to formulate it in my mind. You're saying that the answers weren't prejudicial, but isn't it true that some questions can be prejudicial, regardless of what the answer is? And isn't that, in fact, kind of what the appellant's arguing here?
Your Honor, it's my understanding that the jury was instructed not to pay attention to the attorney's questions, that it's the actual evidence that's presented as a result of whatever question comes out. Now, the question puts in context the answer. But based upon this record, we don't know if the prosecutor was, in fact, reading from a transcript, from the recordings, or what was going on.
But if the attorney didn't follow the judge's ruling, he didn't admit that evidence. So if you ask a question that the judge, I think, pretty strongly suggested shouldn't be asked, does that change the analysis at all?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that the question that was asked was in violation of anything that the trial court, that the district judge had ordered. There wasn't any discussion in those three questions about Mark being in custody or anything like that.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not criticizing the judge at all. This was a long trial. These were long days. And if an attorney asked a question dealing with a piece of evidence that the judge had kept out and maybe didn't recognize immediately that the question was being asked about a piece of evidence that they kept out, I'm just wondering if that's some kind of prosecutorial misconduct.
No, I don't believe it is, and the reason I say that is because the prosecutor, right before he asked the question, sought clarification from the district court and said, this is my understanding of your ruling. We don't get to admit the recording, but I get to ask questions, and the prosecutor didn't say I'm only going to ask three questions, but I get to ask questions, there will be an answer, and I can't use whatever evidence it was the prosecutor had as extrinsic evidence to say, Brian, you're lying.
So the record wouldn't support any kind of inference that the prosecutor is trying to slip something past the judge?
I don't believe so at all, Your Honor. I think the prosecutor was pretty darn careful in asking, and wisely asking, for that clarification because of the confusion that may have resulted as a result of the court's initial ruling. And then the court, I don't think he reversed his decision. He never said the recordings were coming in. He said the prosecutor came up with a new way to admit it. It's kind of like hearsay. Somebody says something, objection, Your Honor, hearsay. And the prosecutor comes back and says, excited utterance. Oh, well, then it can come in. That's kind of what we have here. The prosecutor simply had a new theory of giving something in. Although it wasn't the same thing he wanted, it was just the questions.
And I'd also like to go back in your previous comments, sir. You mentioned Rutledge or another case, another defendant. I might have to go back in the record.
Pierce?
No, not a case. But you said this only happened as a result of Brian mentioning an R word. Not Roger, thank God.
Randy.
Oh, Randy Baldwin.
Yeah.
Yes, apparently. And
please explain that to me.
Yes, and I apologize, Justice.
No, Brown, that's fine.
Because I didn't go back and read the entirety of Brian's testimony and preparing for the argument. But the prosecutor's argument was that Ryan testified as to something involving Randy Baldwin. Randy Baldwin was...
Okay, now I understand. And as a result of that information, during trial, the prosecutor went to IDOC and said, hey, look around this area, and that's when they found the recording.
Yes, that's my understanding, Your
Honor. Thank you very much.
I missed something, though. You said... I missed what you said. He was responding, or he was testifying in response to Randy Baldwin, and I missed.
Yeah. And again, I apologize, Justice Brody. He was testifying. I don't recall what the exact scenario was regarding Ryan's testimony as to Randy Baldwin. But it had to do with the fact that Baldwin had been investigated for some criminal activity, was in federal court, and ended up being acquitted after he represented himself. Now, I'm not saying that was all in the transcript, but that was the exculpatory evidence that the state disclosed prior to trial that the prosecutor said was only disclosed to Mark Langford's trial counsel. And that Brian shouldn't have known about this potentially exculpatory evidence, impeachment evidence, whatever you want to call it. And as a result of Brian at least mentioning Randy Baldwin or talking about that in some fashion in his testimony, the prosecutor's lights went on, and he went, okay, this solidifies the deal. They've been talking to each other or through a third party. And Brian had specifically said, I haven't talked to anybody about my testimony. I've talked to Mark, to my brother Mark. I haven't talked to a third party. The state would respectfully ask that the court affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
6 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I do want to address some of the things we've just heard from counsel. With respect to Randy Baldwin issue, the record is pretty murky on this, but I want to point out one important fact. And that basically, when the prosecution said, Judge, we have this evidence that we never disclosed and we'd like to use it now in the middle of the trial, it kind of had two excuses for doing so. One was, hey, we never listened or asked the Department of Corrections to have access to any of these recordings of these conversations for all these years. We didn't do that because we didn't have a reason to, which I would submit to the court is a pretty low standard for expectations of how a prosecutor should investigate a case. But at any rate, the prosecution said we suddenly had a reason to look into those recordings, which, by the way, the defense counsel can't even ask for. From the Department of Corrections, only the prosecution has access to those recordings. But at any rate, the prosecution said it was because we were tipped off by something that Brian said about Randy Baldwin that made us think that there may be some collusion between the defendant and his brother in these phone calls. It's important that the trial court listen to those recordings, and the record is clear about this, and determine that there was no evidence of collusion from those phone calls. So with respect to what little we have in terms of the state's excuse about not disclosing those recordings sooner, with respect to the Randy Baldwin aspect, I would ask the court in this case to rely on the trial court's determination that that's not an issue. The other...
It sounds like this was a rabbit hole, which, like many rabbit holes, led to another rabbit hole.
I think that's actually putting it kindly to the prosecution, because I am a little concerned that the prosecution may have been a bit disingenuous with the trial court, because the other thing that it said was we were surprised. We didn't realize that Brian was going to come in here and confess. And the record is very clear that that is just plain false, because when you read Brian's testimony as he was called by the prosecution, you see that the prosecution asked for and received permission to treat him as a hostile witness before he even began to testify about homicide. And then the state began to cross-examine him about all of his previous statements and made statements to him like, it sounds like you're probably going to testify differently today.
Okay, just so I'm clear, you're saying that the state wasn't surprised that a witness that they called confessed?
Correct.
And I'm just help me understand why that would be disingenuous, because usually one would think that that would be the last person they want to call.
Well, first it's Brian Langford, which Brian Langford is the key to the state's entire case. And they knew that they had to call Brian Langford because, as I've argued already, he's the only source of evidence for them to get the intent to commit robbery.
But had he confessed in the other trials where he testified?
So Brian gave detailed testimony about every, not only did he confess in this trial, he also gave detailed testimony about every other time that he had given an inconsistent statement with his confession. And he detailed how he had been giving promises, favors.
Okay, but it's sort of my direct question, though. Had he confessed to the crime the other times he testified?
Well, Judge, sorry, oh my gosh.
It's no drama.
I would refer you to the brief because we really do refer you to the record there. There were moments when he would write letters, when he would make statements to police and so on that were confessions, and I think to journalists, if I remember correctly, but in terms of his trial testimony, he had not confessed.
Okay. So the answer is he had never testified that way until the third trial.
Right.
And you're saying that they were disingenuous to be surprised by that.
Right, because they said to him, hey, before we even talk about murders in this case, let's talk about all of the inconsistent statements you've made in the past. And then they cross-examined him on all of his prior statements, all of the previous times that he had said that Mark had something to do with homicides. That's not consistent with being surprised that he was going to testify differently at the trial.
Is it consistent with Brian's inconsistency, though?
Sure, but then to drop evidence into the defense's lap after or during Brian's testimony and then claim that one of the reasons that they should be allowed to do it is because they just didn't realize that they were going to have to impeach Brian Langford. Come on. I mean, and I'm not saying that to you, Your Honor. I'm saying that to the state. I mean, come on. That's not plausible.
But they haven't been able to talk to Brian before trial either, have they?
Brian, according to the record, they had not refused. But again, they were ready for him. And they made every effort to impeach him before he had a chance to confess. I am nearly out of time. I did want to briefly address the 613 issue. I wanted to point out that recordings and substantive statements, there's no, in terms of a 403 analysis, there's no difference between a recording and having the jury know what's on the recordings. And I do want to point out that during the cross-examination of Brian, related to those recordings, the state asked the question, the counsel skipped over some in one of the questions, and the state's question was, in a call to your brother Lee John Langford following that Gould hearing, you stated to him, I want to get the quote right, so it's obvious that the state was pulling one of these numbers for the jury, and then read the rest of the quote, I'm going to effing blow them out of the water. It was obvious to this jury that the recordings or documentation of these quotes were being quoted from. And so any argument about 403 analysis being different for recordings than the substantive statements, I think is disingenuous.
If I may, I believe to extend passionate.
Yes.
Isn't there a different analysis, though, between whether something is admissible for impeachment purposes? It's possible that it's not unfairly prejudicial if it's used to impeach testimony, but it could be unfairly prejudicial if it's brought up just directly without an impeachment purpose. In other words, if it was being used to contradict something that had already been said versus something that hadn't been said yet.
I think I understand your question, and I'm not sure if in a minute I can formulate
You may answer the question.
Thank you. I think a 613 analysis, I think that this is part of the problem here, is that there are entangled evidentiary issues and Brady issues, but I think ultimately this is a Rule 16 analysis and 403 analysis. There are entangled issues, and one of them would be, what could the state have done properly with an impeachment argument, a 613 argument, instead of kind of what played out. In this case, because so much was done wrong through the impeachment process, because by the state asking the questions improperly, and then ultimately not impeaching with the actual statements. I mean, this was an incomplete attempt to impeach. That's part of what is so prejudicial about how it was then weaponized in the closing arguments. Because ultimately, the state's counsel testified. Brian didn't testify to these statements. Counsel testified to these statements. And then argued that Brian had made those statements. And that was what the jury heard when it went into that deliberation room. And it stands to reason that that is a huge reason why they returned a verdict that ultimately rejected Brian Langford's confession. Because they were told these statements that he made, even though he didn't actually make them at the trial, that he made are the reason they came into this court with a motive to lie. That's why these statements were so prejudicial. So whether the state and wasn't arguing it but was thinking maybe we can get the sentence 6 months or not, ultimately has no bearing on the impact that it had to the defense. And I would just add also that a 403 analysis would still be appropriate for a 613 argument in a situation, well, because the state would be, or excuse me, the defense would be entitled to try to rehabilitate after that impeachment. But because these statements were inextricably entangled with the context being Mark's incarceration, the defense was completely hamstrung and unable to rehabilitate. So it would have been a proper ruling from the trial court to say, even if your argument is 613, the defense can't do anything with it. They don't have their right to rehabilitate would be violated. And so either way, you end up in the same place.
You were right. It took more than a minute.
Thank you. Sir, thank you very much. Counsel, to both of you, thank you for your good argument today. It's good to be with all of you again. Thanks for the travels that everyone has been here today. And on this matter under advisement, we'll render a decision. Looking forward to meeting with the students at some point after we conference these cases. Thank you very much.
All rise, please.